Hi, this is Dr. Kenyatha Loftus, host of New Books in Political Science. We are here today talking with Dr. Julietta Waugh, Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies at San Diego State University, about her new book, Trafficking Women's Human Rights. Dr. Waugh analyzes how discourse on human trafficking creates the boundaries of victimhood and thereby restricts concepts of punishment, remedy, and citizenship. Analyzing legislation, public discourse, and interview materials, Dr. Waugh traces how gender, nationality, and racial identities become inscribed into the concept of sex trafficking. The subject matter is heavy, but Dr. Waugh presents a delightfully rigorous theoretical framework, careful interpretation of proffered data, and poignant illustrations. I enjoyed reading this book and entertaining its thesis, and I enjoyed speaking with its author, Dr. Julietta Waugh. So, here we are, New Books in Political Science, talking with Julietta Waugh about trafficking women's human rights. Listen in.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Political Science. We're here today with Dr. Julietta Waugh, Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies at San Francisco State University. And we're here talking about her new book, Trafficking Women's Human Rights. Julietta, it's good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, can you just tell us a little bit about your background to get us started?
Sure. I when I was first kind of a college student, I was a political science major. I was really interested in just politics in general and political theory more specifically. But then I kind of veered toward the, you know, gender and politics, and so I ended up taking some courses in women's studies, and eventually I found that I was also piqued kind of by the question of race and race relations in the U.S., and so I did a PhD program in ethnic studies, race and ethnic studies, and that kind of led me to where I am now, which is back in women and gender studies.
Awesome. Can you tell us how you got started on this particular book, Trafficking Women's Human Rights?
Well, this book came out of kind of a broader, my broader interest in thinking about why it was that even though we kind of know better than to, I don't know, use these kinds of neocolonial or sometimes very racist assumptions around quote unquote the backwardness of others, specifically when you're thinking about like global politics and the way in which oftentimes like the so-called third world gets framed as not just economically but socially and culturally backward, and how that gets used to explain kind of continued inequalities. And it seems like people know that that's kind of not an okay framework, but on the other hand, it seems like it still persists. And so my bigger question was why, and why does it still persist, and what is it that kind of keeps us, keeps that frame kind of in the picture? And when I was looking at human rights, it seemed like those frames that I saw as problematic and many other people see as problematic kept still kind of cropping up in the background, especially in the ways in which oftentimes human rights violations are, you know, represented through the quote-unquote other women in other places. Mm-hmm. And so I was curious as to why that was the case. Like, why don't we in the U.S., for instance, why aren't we willing to see kind of human rights violations in the so-called industrialized or developed world more easily than we tend to see it in these other places? So that's kind of the bigger questions that I was interested in and that led me to specifically this book.
Awesome. Well, let's dive in. You begin with a discussion of the legal stakes of human trafficking. Can you talk to us about those?
I do. Sure. I was, you know, I was kind of interested more broadly in looking at why there are certain kinds of human rights figures that continually persist. Like another figure would be the victim of female genital circumcisions or female genital mutilation. And so, you know, I was kind of more broadly interested in why certain kind of figures continue to represent human rights and specifically women's human rights violations. But I decided just to focus on trafficking because it was kind of a like a topic that had gained like a greater part of the national imagination in like the more recent years, particularly with the passage of the 2000 law, the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act. So I started there, and that was kind of why I was interested in, or I started with the kind of legal frames to understand how something like sex or trafficking, and more specifically sex trafficking, could become kind of a legal issue for you, like U.S. citizens.
Very interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about, I guess let's just move to the next chapter and talk about universalism and the conceptual limits of human rights. And I'm very intrigued by this notion of the paradox of universalism.
Yes, I am too. I mean, I feel like one of the things that, one of the bigger questions that I had was, you know, it seems really important to be attentive to cultural difference and particularity, especially kind of in the, you know, age of multicultural discourses and cultural relativism and all of that stuff. And yet at the same time, I felt like oftentimes those same kind of cultural differences were used to explain like failures for certain kinds of communities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the general, that's the bigger question that I had when I was looking at kind of the chapter one. And specifically, you know, the thing with human rights is that there's always this kind of need to make some claim to like a universal set of principles or universal set of rights, or even like a universal conception of what makes humanity humanity, right, on the basis of which you would extend some sort of protection or kind of mutually agreed to recognition of like the being of others. And so it seemed like that's a good thing. And yet at the same time, it seems like historically there's been a lot of, just like a lot of, no one's ever been able to agree on what exactly that is. No one's ever been able to come up with a set of principles that everyone agrees is going to work in terms of defining a set of rights. And so my question was, you know, why is it maybe there's something in the whole project of wanting to try to find universal principles that is itself presenting limits. Like maybe it's just the frame of universalism itself that might be, you know, posing these kinds of limits and conditions. And so that's what I wanted to look at.
So you're saying that it's we're having difficulty defining what it means to be human?
I think so. I think there's always been, or I would say, you know, how we define human has always changed and shifted. I don't think it's ever like a stable or, you know, to me, my perspective is that we're always kind of continuously redefining or defining how we define, you know, humanity and what makes us different from, I don't know, things that we see as not human. And so, yeah, so in that sense, I feel like it's constantly something that's being made and remade, and human rights is one place where I think those processes, you can see how that process takes place, or it's one place where you can see that process taking place.
And so in this desire to construct a kind of a table of what should be universal rights, we're having a hard time. Can you talk to us a little bit more about what that means? What are the implications of that?
The implications of having a hard time defining what it means?
Yes. Having a hard time defining what it means to be human and
sure.
Trying to apply this kind of in an international frame.
Right. Yeah. And it, I mean, as a lot of people have pointed out, you know, different people in different places have different conceptions of what it is that makes humans humans and what that entitles one to. And you can even see it in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which I try to talk a little bit about in that chapter. Like, that came out of a specific historical, political context right after World War II, entering into the kind of Cold War. And so there are a set of rights that that document articulates that are much more, they come much more out of the tradition of understanding humanity and its entitlements from the kind of liberal, like British, U.S. Tradition. But on the other hand, there's also a set of rights that comes much more out of the kind of socialist revolutions, and that was a very different way of thinking about the entitlements that one has access to on the basis of being human. And so I think that document is a good example of how different kind of viewpoints and different people had different perspectives on what it meant to kind of claim humanity and then what those entitled, what that claim entitled one to. And I think it still persists. And so I'm just, I guess in this chapter I was interested in trying to understand how it might be, I mean, I don't actually know that it's possible to make a claim to universalism, and that's why I talk about the paradox. And I don't know that I have an alternative necessarily, and I'm not saying that the desire to want to claim universalism is necessarily bad. It's just I was interested in understanding how, like, what the limits are, like what you can make that claim, but then you have to be attentive to the fact that there are limits to the extent that you can make the claim, and then making the claim might sometimes also, you know, it establishes a set of assumptions already that you also, I think, should be attentive to, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. It absolutely does. You talk about the liberal kind of Euro-American tradition and as compared to the socialist tradition, for example. Can you talk about what these two ideas mean with respect to what it means to be a woman, defining womanhood?
Sure. Yeah. So in the kind of tradition of the what I call like the first set of rights in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the perspective is very much based on that the Enlightenment tradition, as I say, where it's framed in terms of like individual rights to which someone is entitled to and must have the protection from the state. And then those kind of social, the rights that come out of the socialist revolutions are more framed about around the social, the entitlements to which the state is obligated to kind of ensure. And so it was two really different perspectives on how to think about rights. In the kind of liberal tradition, or the, I should say, British Anglo-American tradition of the individual rights, in terms of gender, I feel like, as people like Joan Scott have talked a lot about, the focus on individualism meant that oftentimes it was the, or maybe I should put it this way, one of the things I like about something that Joan Scott, the historian, had wrote about was that in these kind of individual liberalist traditions, even though the focus was on ensuring and defining the individual citizen, that individual citizen also had to be was unique, but also had to be something that was kind of universal at the same time. So there had to be some sort of shared notion of the citizen, even while there was also this recognition that he was unique. And she argues that gender was exactly what enabled the kind of generic idea of the citizen to also be unique, because he was unique from, for her, like women as citizens. And so that's a kind of tension that I also see happening, not just through gender or gendered frames, but also through these kinds of cultural and racial frames. You know, that there's this kind of desire, you have to have this kind of, even while you recognize the uniqueness of the individual citizen subject, there also has to be some sort of acceptance that he or she is also not unique, right? It's just like everybody else. And so there's always some, so in that sense, there's difference becomes a way to articulate uniqueness, even while it's subsumed under this general idea of universality.
Awesome. We're talking today with Dr. Julietta Hua, Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies at San Francisco State University, and we're talking to her about her book, Trafficking Women's Human Rights. The way you begin Chapter 2 is very intriguing. You start with the stories of Zipporah Mazindo and Eva Petrova.
Yes.
And you talk about the privileging of certain types of formulations over others and certain types of narratives over others. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I was definitely – one of the things that really intrigued me about trafficking and the way that trafficking has become kind of a social and political kind of issue for the U.S. kind of mass audience was that there seemed to be a very particular kind of story of victimization that often accompanied this idea of trafficking. And those stories seem to, as many other kind of feminist scholars have pointed out, the stories are oftentimes problematic because they don't allow us to see how the violences of trafficking might actually happen in other kinds of ways or manifest themselves differently, and that we might not be able to see them. And I happen to find, and actually I should say that my graduate student of mine actually found this Eva Petrova case, which was really interesting because in that case she actually says to the courts that she was kind of asked or encouraged by the U.S. authorities to narrate herself in a particular way in order to enable the U.S. authorities to make this anti-trafficking or this trafficking prosecution case, and then also for her to be able to claim that she was a victim and then get the kind of benefits that come from that. And she later retracts those statements and actually says, you know, I was, that's not how I see myself. And it just happened to be one of kind of many trafficking prosecution cases, and it's the only one that we could find where it was, you know, documented that one of the witnesses and purported victims had actually come out and said, you know, that's not actually how I saw myself, and I was kind of forced into narrating my experience in a particular way. And it seemed really interesting to think about what's at stake beyond just the fact that, you know, there might be other victims that don't get recognized because they don't fit into those stories, but also, like, what those stories say about how we, the kind of assumptions we not just have but help produce around women who are victimized specifically by trafficking.
Very cool. I was intrigued by this notion of I have to be a certain, I have to, well, one, she had to claim victimhood, and then like a certain type of victimhood to be, for her situation to be understood, and that she, Eva, decided to be exported back to Russia instead of continuing this narrative in the court.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And there's a woman, her name is Dina Haynes, who wrote a really nice article, which she talks about how that story or that kind of predetermined frame of victimization, she calls it the chain to a bed and a brothel narrative. And it's something that comes up often when you think about, when you read about, and when we read about generally like sex work and prostitution as well, that somehow it's hard for us kind of socially and culturally to think about sex work as something that's not necessarily, or that's not totally coerced. And I just wanted to, you know, kind of complicate those things.
Yeah. In chapter three, you talk about writing stories of victimization and rescue. And you end the chapter kind of with this discussion of a lady who says, well, I'm not going to tell the story that way because I don't want to hurt what I have going on here. And, you know, part of that, I don't want to hurt what I have going on here is ambiguous. But the reporter takes it as, oh, she doesn't want to she could be referring to that she doesn't want to hurt her life as she has it, or she doesn't want to, you know, there are many ways, but the reporter takes it in a way that privileges his work in that situation. So can you talk about the kind of the work of reporters as heroes or as rescuers in these narratives of victimization?
Definitely. So it's not just in the, what I found was that it's not just in these legal cases of trafficking prosecution cases where, and it makes sense, in a legal kind of criminal case, you need a distinguishable victim and you need a distinguishable criminal. And, you know, the point is to make those distinctions very clear and make it clear to the jury and the judge and everything. But I also saw that happening not just in the legal space or the space of the courtroom, but also in these news media stories and also documentaries on trafficking. And the example that you bring up is an interesting one, because I think what happens is that oftentimes we read news stories and we take them as kind of just like statements of truth or fact. And, you know, in some ways they are. But we don't often think about how they're framed. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like, especially with this particular story around trafficking that Nicholas Kristof writes, you can see how you can see how he himself is kind of interpreting and reframing the response of the woman that he's interviewing, so that she actually gives these very ambiguous answers, but he interprets them to kind of validate his argument, which is that she is in fact being kind of victimized as, you know, a sex trafficking victim working in this brothel in Cambodia.
Yeah, that was very intriguing. Another way that kind of our ideas of trafficking are framed are through race and sexuality. And in chapter four, you talk about origin stories and public images of trafficking. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to do, for me, the book kind of is, one, trying to understand the limits of universalism, two, trying to kind of complicate this idea of the narrative of victimization that gets attached to certain kinds of violences like trafficking, and then three, thinking about how those narratives help construct this idea of cultures that are both culpable and also complicit. And what I found then in looking at that was that these cultures were also framed as framed through kind of sexual and racialized meanings. And so in the fourth chapter, the one that looks at public images or focuses kind of a little bit more on public images, because it was kind of based in these visual examples, I thought it would be a good place to think about or talk a little bit about how the cultures of kind of culpability are made recognizable to U.S. audiences through these racialized and sexualized frames. And so when in sex trafficking discourses, there's a kind of story that trafficking happens, you know, mostly to Asian women, and then also obviously Latin American and African women, and then also kind of to Eastern European or women from the former Eastern Bloc. And it was interesting to me how those different stories of why trafficking happens to people in those places gets juxtaposed against each other. And I focused mostly on, or just for this purpose, on the story of the origin of sex trafficking in Asia versus the story of the origin of sex trafficking in Eastern Europe, to think about how those stories actually help, are both based on and also help to shape racial discourses around whiteness, around national belonging, around Asian difference. So, and how those racial meanings are specifically tied to how how those racial meanings are specifically tied to sexuality.
Mm-hmm. And something you sprinkled throughout the book, and I wanted to give you a chance to talk about, were alternative ways of thinking about human rights or human trafficking. So, you know, in the when you talked about your interest and motivations for this project, you talked about your experience of hearing kind of the same stories over and over, right? And so I was wondering, well, I'm someone who hears the same stories. I didn't have an alternative framework in mind. What are some alternative stories I could hear that would be available?
Sure. And, you know, I'm not – it's always the hard part about, I think, doing this kind of work where you're just, like, pointing out things that you find kind of troubling. Is that everyone wants solutions, and I don't necessarily know that I have a solution. And the solution I do have is to, I think it's important to be attentive to what's happening kind of beneath the surface, as to like requote an anti-trafficking campaign. because I think that if we're more attentive to how we're seeing things and the ways in which we're looking and what that might mean and how that might actually help, how we look might actually be reinforcing or being based on kind of assumptions we already have around difference and around, I don't know, victimization and all of these other things, then I think that it opens up your field of vision in a sense. And I think that's always a good thing. And I guess that's kind of my hope, is that, you know, even though it is a kind of a critique, that the critique is also convincing people that it's important to have of that kind of critical eye to see what else is going on.
Awesome. We are talking to Dr. Julietta Hua, Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies at San Francisco State University, about her book, Trafficking Women's Human Rights. In Chapter 5, you talk about the title of the chapter is Refiguring Slavery, Constructing the United States as a Racial Exception. And you talk about how tying the idea of trafficking to slavery has implications for how we understand what is going on with human rights there. Can you talk to us about that chapter a little bit?
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, it's kind of everywhere how stuff on, you know, when people talk about trafficking, they oftentimes talk about it as a kind of modern day slavery. And I wasn't so much interested in trying to say that it was or it wasn't slavery. What I was interested in seeing was what's the effect, you know, what's the impact of using that language to describe trafficking? And specifically, it seemed to me that using this language of transatlantic slavery that was, you know, that's kind of clearly placed in the U.S. past, and using that language to reference or describe kind of quote-unquote modern-day trafficking was a place where I could really unpack how, you know, these kinds of racial discourses that we often think of as very domestic, how they actually are also about the quote-unquote global. And so in some ways, I guess what I'm trying to say and what I wanted to do in that chapter was to connect how human rights, which is often, when we think about human rights and talk about human rights, we often don't talk about it in terms of race. We often talk about it in terms of culture and nation, but not necessarily race. And when we talk about race relations, especially kind of in the domestic context, we don't actually think of it as global per se, right? We think about it in the context of like the U.S., U.S. political relations, the U.S. past, and all of these things.
Absolutely.
And what I wanted to do was actually draw those two things together, because I think that how we think about race domestically always has a kind of global scope. For instance, I talk a little bit about how the racialization of Asian Americans, for example, as a lot of Asian American scholars have pointed out, has always depended on this kind of imagined Asian outside. And so, you know, Asian Americans have been racialized as kind of perpetual foreigners, and that racialization depends on this imagining of an Asia that's not the U.S., right, that's outside. And in that sense, it's always a kind of global process, or it's a process that evokes a kind of global scene. And in the same ways, I think that when we think about human rights, it is about culture, but in the same ways, when we talk about culture, we can't help but also, there's also this kind of backdrop of race that's always informing how we think about culture. And that doesn't necessarily get talked about very explicitly, I think, in a lot of discussions around human rights. And so that was something I wanted to draw out a little bit. And it seemed like it was a good place to do that when thinking about how the use and of the frame of transatlantic slavery gets evoked to describe modern-day trafficking, and how that works to kind of establish specifically a kind of U.S. national mythology that's very much about constructing a sense of the United States as this kind of multicultural place that's overcome racism to some extent, right, and is thus poised to address kind of the quote-unquote new problems of human rights and trafficking.
Awesome. We're talking to Dr. Julietta Hua, Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies at San Francisco State University, about her book, Trafficking Women's Human Rights. So tell us how you conclude the book.
Well, I wanted to really, the conclusion's really kind of homage to my students, because my students have really, every semester, it doesn't matter, like every class, every new set of students, they're always really, here, especially at San Francisco State, they're really, really interested in action and social action. And they really want to know, what can we do? How is this, like, how can we be active? And, how is this about changing things on the ground? And so one of the things I wanted to do was show how, like, the questions that we tend to think about or describe as abstract or conceptual are very much about the day-to-day and the real. Like, how we think about the quote-unquote real helps shape the real into how we know it, if that makes any sense at all. And so, the fact that we have this kind of reservoir of knowledge and this backdrop through which to look at something and to understand it in a certain way helps us understand that thing that way, and then helps us, like, respond, or think about shaping responses. And so in the conclusion, what I wanted to do was try to connect how the conceptual is very much how we come to think about the real actually helps shape the real itself. And so to try to tie together the conceptual with the what people sometimes call the material or the real. And so it's something that you can see, I think, really clearly in trafficking, in the kind of trafficking discourse, because it was something that came to be in 2000 with the law. It made it necessary to be able to look at something, pinpoint it, and define it as trafficking. But then how we come up with those definitions and how we, like, you know, define victims as trafficking victims rather than just undocumented immigrants or, I don't know, sex workers, that became that actually helped shape, right, who can really become a trafficking victim. And so that was my hope, was to be able to show people how it's important to think about how we think in order to kind of understand what we think of as, like, you know, the real.
Absolutely. That comes through in the book. You do an excellent job. I really enjoyed reading
this
book. You're
very generous. Thank you.
We were talking to Dr. Julieta Hua, Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies at San Francisco State University, about her book, Trafficking Women's Human Rights. Julieta, before you go, I want to know what do you have cooking? What's up next?
What do I have next? I guess I'm going to try to take a vacation. But I have, you know, it was something that's been interesting for me, and I don't know if it's necessarily something that I'm interested in doing myself, but I would like other people to think about, is how to, the kind of post 9/11 moment in which this kind of trafficking discourse becomes very prominent in the U.S. public imagination, how it maybe coincides or resonates with the kind of war on terror. That's something that I didn't really talk, you know, I don't talk about at all, but it's something that I've been thinking about, is how the frame of, like, the war on terror also helps inform how we think about human rights and specifically trafficking. So that's just, like, a broader question. Yeah.
And no insight on what your next book is going to look like?
I'm sorry? Can you repeat that?
We get no tips on what your next book are going to look like.
Well, I do have... I do have another kind of book project interest. It's very different on the surface, but I hope that the questions are actually very similar. But that book is actually about how – it's actually about animals.
Huh.
Yes. And so I guess I don't know if I should say more.
I'm officially intrigued. Do tell.
I mean, generally, I'm kind of interested in looking at why animal studies, just to kind of put a blanket term on a lot of different kinds of political and intellectual projects, what's at stake when animal studies is framed through the kind of framework of rights. So I feel like there's two dominant ways of approaching the question of animals, or non-human animals, I should say. And one is to emphasize rights, right? Or it's this kind of ethical obligation of humans to recognize the rights of non-human animals. And then the other frame that's oftentimes evoked is the kind of affective frame, the humans should and do care about animals, and we should respect that there is this kind of care. Or this kind of emotional or affective frame, and that should be the basis of recognizing some sort of non-human animal right, I guess. And I'm kind of interested in, like, what gets lost when it's just framed as a question of ethics and rights and or emotion and affect. So that's kind of broadly.
I want to read that book. I will buy that book.
And I'm hoping actually to do interviews with people who work at chimpanzee sanctuaries. And I've done a couple, and it's been really interesting. I mean, I'm just really interested, not necessarily in the animals, the chimpanzees per se, but in what kind of draws people to do that, the work that they do in caring for non-human animals.
Wow. Wow. Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. This is Dr. Julieta Hua, Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies at San Francisco State University. We talked to her today about her book, Trafficking Women's Human Rights. Julieta, thank you so much.
Thank you. It has been a real pleasure.
This is Kenyatta Loftus, host of New Books in Political Science, and we've just spoken with Dr. Julieta Hua, Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies at San Diego State University, about her new book, Trafficking Women's Human Rights. It's something fabulous for you to read. Until next time.